Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Ed Weisbart of the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the damage that will be done to the nation's healthcare system if a lawsuit backed by President Trump ends the Affordable Care Act. Tim Judson, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who reflects on the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, the current state of the nuclear industry, and the growth of renewable energy alternatives. And Benny Nsumbu, a senior at Cooperative Arts and Humanities High School in New Haven, who explains why she and other students are advocating the inclusion of African American studies in Connecticut's public school curriculum. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations is examining a plan to relocate 100,000 Rohingya Muslims who fled mass violence in Myanmar 2 years ago to an isolated island on the Bay of Bengal called Bashan Char. The Bangladesh government says that moving Rohingya refugees to the muddy island will take pressure off overcrowded camps along its southern border, where almost 1 million Rohingya Muslims live in cramped tent cities. Human rights critics say the low-lying island is vulnerable to extreme flooding and typhoons, and so its use could trigger a new humanitarian crisis. The UN Refugee Agency has said nearly $1 billion was needed for the Rohingya in Bangladesh, but only a tiny fraction of those funds have been raised thus far. The plan to move the Rohingya to the island is said to be voluntary, which critics maintain will cause the plan to fail. Matthew Smith of the advocacy group Fortify Rights blasted the UN for endorsing the relocation plan. Smith told the British newspaper The Daily Telegraph, "Bashan Char should be off the table. It's difficult at this stage to imagine any Rohingya volunteering to go, but coercion comes in many shapes and sizes." The US Supreme Court is contemplating hearing two cases that could further weaken union rights, collective bargaining, and the foundational principle of majority rule. In the 2018 Janus ruling, the court declared non-union workers were not required to contribute fees that pay for collective bargaining. In the case Uradnik versus Interfaculty Organization, a Minnesota professor, Kathleen Uradnik, is challenging the law that establishes the right of public employees to select an exclusive bargaining agent through a majority vote. Uradnik declares that this constitutes a violation of her free speech rights. Were the challenge to be affirmed by the Supreme Court, it would undermine unions' role as the exclusive bargaining agent for workers. In the second case, plaintiff Terry Bierman uses a similar argument to challenge a different Minnesota law that allows home care providers to select an exclusive representative. The American Prospect concludes that both Minnesota cases are very clearly part of a legal strategy long in the making. Should the court rule in favor of the plaintiffs in either case, it would be a major step toward undercutting workers' representational rights. If activist conservative justices find merit to the radical proposition that majoritarian democracy is unconstitutional in labor relations, it would be a blow not only to collective bargaining, but to American democracy itself. White supremacist Glendon Scott Crawford conspired to make a radiological death ray to target the local Muslim community in upstate New York. The weapon never worked, but in 2015, Crawford was convicted of attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction and is now serving a 30-year prison sentence. His co-defendant, Eric Fate, who had agreed to build a remote control for Crawford's weapon, was convicted of providing material support to terrorism, the first and only time federal prosecutors have used the material support law against a domestic extremist since the 9/11 attacks. In 1996, federal prosecutors used the law to go after members of the West Virginia Mountaineer Militia, charged with plotting to blow up an FBI building. According to the investigative news site The Intercept, the material support law has been commonly used against foreign terrorists in over 400 cases since 2001. Yet the same law is rarely used against white nationalists or other domestic terrorists. After the 9/11 attacks, the US Justice Department created the National Security Division. From that point to today, all terrorism-related charges, including material support and the use of weapons of mass destruction, had to be approved by the National Security Division. After the DOJ's new bureaucracy was established, prosecutions for domestic terrorism using the material support law sharply declined. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
After congressional Republicans failed in their more than 70 attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, widely known as the ACA or Obamacare, President Trump has adopted a new strategy to end the now popular health insurance program. Trump directed the U.S. Justice Department on March 25th to file a legal brief supporting a lawsuit by conservative attorney generals, upheld by a lower federal court, that ruled the ACA was unconstitutional. If upheld by higher courts, ending the ACA would, by some estimates, eliminate 20 million Americans' health coverage. Dissolving the program would also dramatically reduce Medicaid coverage for millions more and remove protections for some 50% of non-elderly Americans with pre-existing conditions. Although Mr. Trump campaigned for president, promising the country that he would replace Obamacare with something better, his administration put forward regulations that will increase premiums for sick Americans, allowed the sale of junk insurance plans that cover very little, and permitted state Medicaid programs to require beneficiaries to work, which has led to thousands of low-income citizens to lose their coverage. When asked in recent days what will replace the ACA if he wins his court case, Trump said a replacement plan won't be announced until after the 2020 election, and then only if Republicans win. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Ed Weisbart, chair of the Missouri chapter of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Here, Dr. Weisbart assesses the damage that will be done to the nation's healthcare system if the lawsuit ending Obamacare is upheld.
If we reverse the law, we'll suddenly go back to these even worse insurance policies that have no limit on what, you know, they can start today. They can not restrict you by the dollar amount of your health care. They used to put $1 million limits on your care, which you could burn through in a few days, in a week or two in a hospital. They used to not cover things if you were sick beforehand. They used to not sell you insurance. They used to drop you when you got sick. There's a long list of things that the country as a whole has frankly started to take for granted now, because they are improvements. They are better than how things used to be, and it's hard to imagine losing them. But that is indeed the current administration's plan, is to take away health care from tens of millions of people and make it worse for many of the rest of us. So it's a dreadful problem. We'll see worsening of diseases and other things like that. So it's a terrible strategy for them. On the other hand, they really have managed to put healthcare front and center in our debate again. So good for them, you know, renewed attention to this topic.
If upheld by the courts, as I understand it, dismantling Obamacare would not only throw the tens of millions of people off their ACA insurance plans, but would end Medicare expansion, would affect many millions more, repeal protections for people with pre-existing conditions, which pretty much affects almost everybody living here in America. And so we're talking about tens of millions, probably over 100 million people would be negatively affected by the repeal of Obamacare. Do I have that right?
No, I think that's exactly right. And even if you're not in one of the groups that are directly affected, having an insurance mechanism for these new people means that hospitals don't have to transfer the cost of that onto the insured, the otherwise insured. So it hasn't done nearly enough to control the cost of insurance, but it has done quite a bit. And you're right. We'll see, I don't know what the exact number is, but roughly 10 million people who are now covered by Medicaid, who wouldn't be covered by Medicaid. And understand, most of the people that would be losing this are working people. They're people who work at jobs that are paid minimum wage or barely above minimum wage. They do work that we all rely upon, and it's obscene that they would not be able to have any form of health care. But that's what's going to happen if they do reverse it.
What is your response to the idea that President Trump says that he can work with the Democratic newly controlled House of Representatives in the Senate to come up with a better plan than Obamacare?
I would love that to happen. I have no evidence to base that hope on, but I would love that to happen. His party has had, 9 years now since the passage of the 10 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act to recommend a substitute for the Affordable Care Act. And the reason they can't come up with a better substitute is because the ideas behind the Affordable Care Act originated in their party. They essentially wrote it a long time ago, and it was their best idea that they could come up with, and they don't have anything else. They have not proposed anything else, despite 10 years of talking about repeal and replace. So if Trump decided that he wanted to work with the Democratic Party to move forward on a better solution, I know exactly what that solution should be. It would be improved Medicare for all. I have no confidence that he would go down that road, but, you know, the scenario you're painting of what if Trump wanted to work with us, bring it on. I'd be delighted.
Dr. Weisbart, one last question. We only have about a minute or two left. What do you feel the biggest obstacle is in the United States to establishing a single-payer Medicare for all type system?
Our democracy is on the ropes. We have once again allowed largely moneyed interests to corrupt the way our campaign finance system works. And so our legislators are having to compete for the best campaign finance sources they can get. And they follow the money and do what the big moneyed interests say. We have been through this before. Teddy Roosevelt dealt with it. Every 20 to 40 years, our country goes through having to rescue democracy, and we are down on the ropes again with this. But the good news is healthcare is such an important issue to everyone that I believe people understanding how important healthcare is, how at risk their healthcare is, and how linked that risk is to democracy's survival, I think we can use healthcare to galvanize the rebirth of our democracy in a good way.
That was Dr. Ed Weisbart, chair of the Missouri chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program. Learn more about PNHP and their support for establishing a Medicare for All healthcare system in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. March 28th marked the 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island Nuclear Plant near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the worst accident at a commercial nuclear power plant in the nation's history. A combination of flawed plant design, equipment malfunction, and human error led to a loss of cooling water that resulted in the partial meltdown of the plant's Unit 2 reactor. Although no official evacuation of the area was ordered by the state, then-Governor Dick Thornburg suggested that pregnant women and families with young children leave. Decades later, epidemiological health studies suggest higher rates of cancer among area residents where nuclear radiation was released into the atmosphere. The 1979 accident at TMI dramatically derailed what had, until then, been dramatic growth by the nuclear industry. 51 U.S. reactors were canceled between 1980 and 1984, and no new nuclear reactors were authorized to be built until 2012. Subsequent major disasters at nuclear power plants at Russia's Chernobyl reactor in 1986 and Japan's Fukushima nuclear power station in 2011 have justifiably triggered public opposition to nuclear power worldwide. As a share of domestic energy production, nuclear power provided just under 20% of U.S. electrical generation in 2018. By comparison, over the past 10 years, renewable energy sources, including wind, solar, and hydropower, nearly doubled their share, growing from 9.25% to almost 18% last year. Your reporter spoke with Tim Judson, executive director with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Here he reflects on the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, the current state of the nuclear industry, and renewable energy sources, which are overtaking nuclear power.
You know, it's really important that we talk about what happened at Three Mile Island, you know, even 40 years later, in part because what happened that day has been misconstrued and misreported and downplayed and covered up for the last 40 years. Starting on the day of the accident or the disaster itself, I actually don't say accident, even though that's the term that's usually used, because, you know, what happened at Three Mile Island was not an accident. It was entirely predictable. You know, accident sort of implies, you know, something like a tree blowing over and landing on your car. This was an industrial disaster of a massive scale. There were lots of warning signs and precautions that could have been taken to avoid it and weren't. You know, and it's important to acknowledge that people had responsibility for that. So at Three Mile Island on March 28, 1979, you had what could have been a fairly benign malfunction where you had a leak in a coolant line that shut down the main coolant pumps to the reactor. That triggered a series of events, all of which went badly. The operators misinterpreted some of the alarms and the signals and the gauges that they were reading. Other systems ended up malfunctioning. But what you had was very rapidly, within actually a minute, you had the conditions for a reactor accident or a reactor disaster already taking shape. And so within an hour, basically, of this coolant pump failing, they were losing hundreds of thousands of gallons of water from the reactor being blown out as steam. And that water started to collect and be pumped into an auxiliary building where the intensely radioactive gases that were in that water started to leak to the environment. And the reactor operators didn't realize any of this was happening for over 2 hours. And so by the time they realized that, there was essentially a full-scale nuclear meltdown already underway. Within a few hours later, by that afternoon, there was actually a hydrogen explosion within the reactor building that released large amounts of radiation into the surrounding environment. And by that point, there was virtually no way to contain the radiation that was being released by the reactor.
Tim, what was the effect on the population after decades have gone by? What have long-term studies shown if there's been any effect of that radiation on people's health?
Yeah, the studies that have been done have shown that there's actually been a really significant increase in cancers and other diseases in the communities near Three Mile Island. One of the things that's important to recognize is the official government studies, you know, tend to look in the wrong places to find these problems. It wasn't until the 1990s that an epidemiologist did a study of the effects of the accident that looked at what really happened on that day. What was going on in the, you know, weather-wise in the days around the time of the disaster was that there was an air inversion, a temperature inversion over the Susquehanna River Valley area where Three Mile Island was located. And that trapped the air in the valley from getting over the sides of the hills and into the surrounding area. So basically the radiation that was released from Three Mile Island mostly stayed along the river up and down from where Three Mile Island sits. And if you look at those areas, you find that you find cancers have increased by 2 to 3 times what the normal levels are. So the communities that are around Three Mile Island have really suffered. Due to the releases of radiation during the disaster.
Thank you for that, Tim. Tell us generally what the status of renewable energy sources are here in the United States, sources like wind and solar as it compares to nuclear power right now.
Sure. Well, wind and solar, you know, really are the future, and they're here, and the cost and the quality of the technology with renewable energy generally, but especially with wind and solar, has really just exploded in the last 10 years. Solar now costs, I think, more than 80% less than it did 10 years ago. Wind power is on the order of 40 to 50%, cheaper than it was 10 years ago. Wind and solar are now basically dollar for dollar the most cost-effective forms of generating electricity that we have, even more so than natural gas, which has been, which has really been kind of held up as the cheap new energy source, but now it's wind and solar. The part of the trouble is that the utility industry and the fossil fuel and nuclear industries in particular have been trying to prevent renewable energy from really taking off in the U.S. because it really challenges, their core businesses. So you have, places in the country where renewables have been really encouraged and allowed to take off, and not necessarily in blue states, like California, but also in Texas and Kansas and Iowa. where renewables are growing faster than the nuclear power ever has or ever could probably, and we're really in a position where if you look at what happens when states and local governments do things to encourage renewable energy, do the right things to encourage renewable energy, that we could really have a clean energy revolution taking shape in this country within a few years.
That was Tim Judson, Executive Director with the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. For more information on the long-term effects of the accident at Three Mile Island and the state of the nuclear power industry, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Some Connecticut legislators have introduced bills that would require the teaching of African American or African American and Latinx history in the state's public schools. The proposed legislation, House Bill 7082, is called an act concerning the inclusion of African American studies in the public school curriculum. At the same time, a group of high school students from several New Haven public schools have been working on establishing an African American history curriculum into the local school system as an elective course. That group, Students for Educational Justice, held meetings with some of the bill's legislative sponsors, and a dozen of them testified at a public hearing in March. The students want any bill that's passed to include the study of race and racism to prevent what they call a fun fact session about famous Black Americans. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Benny Nsumbu, a senior at Cooperative Arts and Humanities High School in New Haven. Here she talks about the amendments they want added to House Bill 7082, the efforts they've undertaken to promote passage, and why they want the curriculum to specifically address the experience of African Americans.
Our biggest fear is that it'll turn into just another fun fact session about Black history and won't really talk about race and racism and why there's the racial disparities in America.
So the bill in the legislature basically just says that African American history must be taught in Connecticut schools, but gives no specifics, is that right?
Yes, so that's the bill before our amendments. The reason why we really wanted to get our amendments in there is because just the way that it's written, it doesn't have substance to it. It doesn't really, there's no meat to it. There's nothing that's going to make it effective and sufficient, in schools and really give kids material that they need to understand this.
So what would your group's amendments do?
So one of our amendments is to add a history of race and racism to the title of the bill or the title of the content that will be given to students, because the title of this African American history allows for these people, schools, to really only talk about the basics, which is slavery, the civil rights movement, just shouting, giving names to students and not really going deep into why those things happened and how they're still affecting students or people today. The requirement of teachers to get anti-racial bias training. We did a lot of research before we started this campaign. We met with a bunch of people, principals, teachers, and talked, and we realized that teachers really weren't getting proper training, even if they weren't getting training at all. And if they were, it was not sufficient. And so we wanted to make it required, in this as a law, that teachers would have to get this training, especially if they were going to teach this content. So that's one of our amendments. And then another one was to add create a committee that would oversee the implementation of this content, this course, into schools and making sure that it's done well. And we would make it so that the people on the committee would be reflective of the community. We would have students on there, experts on race, teachers, everyone, the people that would have the knowledge and be the most affected by this law. We wanted to get a committee in there, especially since we weren't confident that the systems in place would make sure that this is done well. We wanted to make sure it would be done well, and we felt that creating a separate committee to specifically oversee this would do it well.
Do the bill's sponsors support your amendments?
So we've talked to Representative Gibson and met with him, and we went over our amendments and the bill the way that it's written, and we were trying to make sure that the amendments were written in a way that, you know, pleased him and would please the legislators that would have to vote on this, because we didn't want it to be so confrontational that, like, they would vote against it. He seemed like he accepted it, and right now we're just waiting.
I know that some members of your group testified that you wanted to just specify teaching of African-American history and race and racism as it relates to African-Americans, but doesn't the bill as of now include Latinx studies as well?
So right now there are two bills. There's HB 7082, which is an act for the inclusion of African-American studies in Connecticut public schools, and then there's HB 7083, which is for the inclusion of Puerto Rican and Latin American studies in public schools, in Connecticut public schools. We don't want it just to turn into ethnic studies, which really does lump all of minorities in America together. It waters down the true story of African Americans, which we feel like you can't talk about other races or the histories of other peoples in America, like Latinx people or Asian Americans, without talking about the history of African Americans, which is very unique because they built this country, and it also goes into like anti-blackness. They can't be anything else because of the color of their skin. And one of our fears is that, like, with the existence of these two bills, that it'll be grouped into ethnic studies. And we don't want it to be ethnic studies. We want to talk about race and racism. To understand race and racism, you have to learn the history of African Americans.
That was Benny Nsumbu with Students for Educational Justice. Learn more about the students' campaign for inclusion of African American history in the Connecticut Public School curriculum by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRGU in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, FRSC in Santa Cruz, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.